Chapter 12. Fermenting Meat, Fish, and Eggs. All around the world, wherever people have faced seasonal scarcity preceded by periods of abundant meat or fish, cultures developed means of preserving these critical food resources. From our vantage point, through the distorted lens of our historical bubble of refrigeration and freezing, it is almost impossible to conceive of how meat and fish can be stored, distributed, and used without these technologies. Flesh is the least stable of any food we eat. At typical ambient temperatures, it rapidly loses its freshness through the action of putrefying bacteria and enzymes. More than any other food, flesh is susceptible to bacterial contamination and regarded as a potentially dangerous vector of contagion. Refrigeration extends the edibility of meat and fish, as well as other foods, essentially by slowing fermentation and enzyme activity. Prior to the advent of refrigeration, people used various other lower-tech approaches to more modest cooling, such as burying, cellars, spring boxes, and ice boxes. Throughout history, people also developed a range of other techniques to stop, slow, or limit the enzymatic and bacterial degradation of meat and fish, including drying, salting, smoking, curing, and, of course, fermentation. These methods have been used in many different combinations. Fish and meat may be dried with or without salting or curing, and with or without smoking, depending upon climate, available resources, and traditions. They may also be salted and/or smoked without being fully dried. The role of fermentation has not always been self-evident, though in many cases the means by which meat and fish are preserved also involve fermentation. In general, limited drying, salting, smoking, and/or curing are used, sometimes along with the addition of other substrates, to strategically create selective environments to inhibit growth of pathogenic bacteria and allow for more desirable forms of microbial growth. Meat and fish in particular are fundamentally different from all the other food substances that people ferment. With only minor environmental manipulation, lactic acid bacteria and yeasts reliably dominate all raw plant substrates, as well as animal products such as milk and honey. To the extent that potentially dangerous microorganisms may be present on these foods, the rapid production of acids and/or alcohol destroys them. In contrast, meat and fish flesh comprises virtually no carbohydrates, the nutrients that support the usual fermentation organisms. Furthermore, interior flesh is sterile, and when it is exposed to a multitude of microbes during slaughtering and butchering, the microbes that typically develop can result in decay and putrefaction in addition to fermentation, a sometimes slippery boundary. The most feared microorganism of them all, Clostridium botulinum, creates no visible decay or perceptible putrefaction, but rather the most toxic substance known to humans, the botulism neurotoxin, fatal at oral doses as small as a single 1/1,000,000th of a gram per kilogram of body weight. Botulism is most widely known in association with low-acid canned foods, including vegetables. This is because C. botulinum, a common soil microorganism, produces spores that are tolerant to extremely high heat. So, if insufficient heat treatment of the canned food succeeds at killing all other bacteria but leaves spores of C. botulinum intact in a low-acid medium, they can develop and produce the neurotoxin, facilitated by the perfectly anaerobic environment of a vacuum-sealed jar or can. Before the invention of canning in the 19th century, botulism was associated with sausages. Ground meat stuffed into casings presents another potentially hospitable anaerobic environment for C. botulinum. The word botulism even derives from the Latin word for sausage, botulus, and it was through people getting sick from uncooked, dry-cured sausages that botulism was first observed and named. Today, in North America, a high proportion of botulism cases are reported in Alaska, where some native people who have traditionally fermented fish in grass-lined pits are now making the mistake of using plastic to contain fish ferments, thereby creating a perfect anaerobic environment for C. botulinum. With this potential in mind, I encourage readers to be sure they understand the parameters for safe fermentation of fish and meat and heed them. In contrast with the realm of raw plant matter, where it is perfectly safe to experiment free from fear, meat and fish have greater potential to be dangerous. This is not intended to discourage you from trying your hand at fermenting meat or fish. Do experiment, but be aware of potential dangers and be smart about it. That said, flesh can be fermented with delicious results. Fermented meat and fish are crucial to survival in some regions of the world and make up some of the greatest culinary delights in many more. In some places, fresh meat and fish have even been regarded with suspicion. To be perfectly honest, I have much more limited personal experience fermenting flesh as compared with plant matter or other animal products, such as honey and milk. My experimentation is ongoing. Despite the limits of my experience, I have extensively researched this realm of fermentation, exploring the literature and visiting, questioning, and corresponding with fellow experimentalists and artisan practitioners. Knowing well that there is a huge amount of interest in this topic and little clear information, I offer this chapter as an overview of meat and fish fermentation concepts and methods, and the broader range of preservation techniques with which it is practiced. Drying, salting, smoking, and curing. When fish or meat is dried, it is precisely in order to prevent microbial and enzymatic transformations. With drying, the objective is to deprive these organisms and processes of the water they need in order to function. C. botulinum, for example, cannot grow in an environment with a water activity, AW, measurement below 0.94, while inhibiting Listeria monocytogenes requires a drier environment, below 0.83 AW. Of course, flesh does not dry instantly, so there is always some level of incidental microbial activity along the way. Botulism is not a concern in this context because the environment is far from anaerobic. In dried meats such as jerky, biltong, and pemmican, and dried fish such as stockfish and salt cod, microbial growth and enzyme activity that occurs during drying may indeed even contribute to the flavor and texture of the resulting product. However, fermentation is not what preserves the flesh. It is the drying that does. Overlapping with drying, there is also salting and smoking. In a dry, cool, sunny climate, such as the coast of Norway, lean fish can be rapidly dried in the air without either salt or smoke. But in many climates, the sun cannot typically dry flesh before putrefaction sets in. Along the Pacific coast of North America, for instance, many native peoples relied upon smoke from smoldering fires to dry salmon. But smoke also transforms food in other ways as it dries. Wood smoke contains many chemical compounds. The sugars in cellulose break apart into many of the same molecules found in caramel, with sweet, fruity, flowery, bready aromas, explains Harold McGee. Wood smoke also produces volatile phenolics and other fragrances, which have the specific aromas of vanilla and clove, as well as generic spiciness, sweetness, and pungency. The chemicals in smoke include not only rich flavors, but also antimicrobial and antioxidant compounds that inhibit the growth of bacteria and fungi, and slow the oxidation of fats that results in rancidity. Unfortunately, residual compounds from smoke in meat and fish may also be carcinogenic to people. Salting has also played an important role in meat and fish preservation, in both products that are dried and those that are not. And heavy salt consumption, too, has been associated with many health problems. Through the physical process of osmosis, salting draws water out of flesh, while simultaneously making the water that remains less available for microbial growth, even without sun, heat, or smoke. In addition to reducing water activity in the flesh, salt itself inhibits certain microorganisms and enzymes. Therefore, the level of salinity is an important determinant of what types of organisms can grow. 10% salt content, extremely salty, inhibits the growth of C. botulinum at typical ambient temperatures and a neutral pH. Much lower salt concentrations can inhibit C. botulinum and other pathogenic bacteria when used in combination with acidification, cool temperatures, and/or limited drying. Curing is closely related to salting. In the preservation of meat and fish, the word cure is simultaneously vague and specific. Broadly, it encompasses all forms of post-harvest ripening. Tobacco, firewood, sweet potatoes, olives, and bacon are among the many plant and animal products that are routinely described as being cured. In the context of preserving meat and fish, curing often means simply the application of salt, often along with spice and sometimes sugar. For instance, the Scandinavian preparation Gravlax is today prepared not by burying salmon underground, as its historical antecedents were, but rather by coating the fish with salt, sugar, dill, and other spices and thus curing it in the refrigerator for several days. The curing reduces the water content of the flesh, limits its microbial and enzymatic degradation, and causes chemical reactions that alter its texture and structure. In some cases, cure has a much more specific meaning, the use of specific mineral salt compounds called curing salts, nitrite and sometimes nitrate, to cause chemical reactions that help preserve meat. Potassium nitrate, KNO3, more commonly known as saltpeter, has long been used as a meat curing agent, as well as an ingredient in gunpowder and more recently in agricultural fertilizers. Historically in meat curing, saltpeter was prized especially for its ability to enhance the red color of meat and was also recognized as improving the safety of the meat and the length of time it could be preserved. After the advent of microbiology, around the beginning of the 20th century, it was recognized that bacteria in the curing meat slowly break down nitrate, NO3, into nitrite, NO2, and that nitrite is actually the compound that preserves meat, rather than nitrate. By reacting with the meat protein myoglobin, nitrite prevents oxidation of fats and produces the bright pink color characteristic of cured meats. By reacting with proteins in some bacterial cells, nitrite deactivates enzymes critical to the growth of C. botulinum and certain other bacteria. Nitrite is used for meat curing primarily in the salt form of sodium nitrite, NaNO2. In longer curing meats, where the slow breakdown of nitrates into nitrites is desirable, sodium nitrate, NaNO3, is also used. Nitrite and nitrate are often described as curing salts, Instacure, or pink salt. These chemicals are used only in minute amounts because in larger doses, nitrite is toxic. Just as it binds with myoglobin in meat, nitrite binds with hemoglobin in our blood to create methemoglobin, which decreases the capacity of the blood to transport oxygen. Some nitrite and nitrate consumption is inevitable. Nitrate is an integral part of the nitrogen cycle and is so common in soil and plant tissue that we typically ingest it every day. Even cabbages and sauerkraut contain nitrate, kraut at slightly higher levels than raw cabbages. Our saliva and digestive tracts break down some of the nitrate we eat into nitrite, and our bodies normally tolerate a limited ongoing level of methemoglobin in the blood. But excessive consumption of nitrite and nitrate causes excessive production of methemoglobin, which can be fatal. U.S. law limits the level of sodium nitrate in cured meat products to 500 parts per million, ppm. And the amount of sodium nitrite to 200 ppm. In the European Union, permitted levels are even lower. Toxicity due to methemoglobin production is not the only health concern about nitrate and nitrite in meat. Nitrite can react with amino acids to form compounds called nitrosamines, especially in the highly acidic environment of our stomachs and the high-temperature environment of a frying pan. Nitrosamines are known to be powerful DNA-damaging chemicals, states Harold McGee. Yet, epidemiological studies have been inconclusive at linking consumption of nitrite-cured meats with increased cancer risk. Still, it's probably prudent to eat cured meats in moderation and cook them gently, concludes McGee. Dry curing basics. Dry curing is simply the direct application of salt to meat or fish. The salt simultaneously draws water out of the meat and absorbs into it. The longer you cure meat in salt, the more stable and salty it will become, explains Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall, whose River Cottage Meat Book has an excellent section on curing meat. Almost any part of any animal will have been tossed or packed or rubbed in salt somewhere in the world. For salt to be the primary means of preservation, typically the meat or fish must be saltier than is generally regarded as palatable. In this case, either meat is used to flavor and salt stews and sauces, or soaked in order to remove salt before consumption. Sometimes salted meats are cured only a short time and then cooked, as with bacon and some styles of ham. In other instances, when salted meats are hung for long aging after the salt has penetrated the meat and lowered water activity enough to make the meat stable and protect against putrefaction, the aged meats are typically eaten raw, as in country hams of the southeastern United States and Italian prosciutto. There is some confusion and dispute as to what aged meat products are actually fermented. Most often, the word fermented is applied to dry cured sausages rather than hams or other whole pieces of meat. In sausages, sugar, often in the form of dextrose, and/or other carbohydrate sources are often mixed with the meat and salt, giving lactic acid bacteria nutrients that enable them to play a more significant role. More on salamis and other dry-cured sausages in the following sections. In hams and other dry-cured meats that are not ground, the internal flesh is never directly touched by tools, hands, or even air. So essentially, the internal ham is sterile from the beginning, points out Peter Zuthen in The Handbook of Fermented Meat and Poultry. Furthermore, carbohydrate ingredients cannot be intermixed with the flesh. As a result, microbial action exerts only a minor role in ripening, according to a study published in the Journal of Applied Microbiology. Yet without question, microorganisms are present. The typical microflora of these meat products is made up of Micrococcaceae, lactic acid bacteria, and molds and yeasts, with the involvement of the Micrococcaceae being very important, explain a team of food scientists in a study of a traditional Spanish style of ham. Their halotolerant, salt-tolerant, character allows them to be permanently present during the manufacturing of the product, and they play an important part in the formation of the color by reducing nitrate to nitrite, and in the proteolytic, protein digesting, and lipolytic, fat digesting, processes, which could contribute to the development of the characteristic flavor of these products. Another study in the Journal of Agricultural and Food Chemistry is more emphatic. Microorganisms are important for the development of flavor in Parma ham, as all of the correlating volatile compounds can be generated by secondary metabolism of microorganisms. My personal experience with dry curing meat is pretty limited. My first time was with a deer thigh given to me by my hunter friend John Whitemore, which I cured in the style of prosciutto. The process is surprisingly simple. First, find a non-metallic container large enough that the meat can lie flat in it. I used a plastic dishwashing tub. Glass or ceramic is fine if you can find the right size, but metal can react with the salt. Some recipes call for using curing salts, but in the case of whole slabs of meat like this, as opposed to dry cured sausages that involve ground or chopped meat stuffed into a casing, the curing salts are for color and flavor rather than safety. Except when safety is at stake, in the case of dry cured sausages, I personally avoid using curing salts and work instead with unrefined sea salt, which naturally contains traces of nitrate. But if you are after the bright color and distinctive flavor that curing salts impart, then by all means use them. Salt the meat using about 6% salt based on the weight of the meat you are curing. 4 pounds or 20 kilograms of meat would require 1/4 pound or 120 grams salt, which measures to roughly 1/2 cup. With clean hands, massage the entire surface of the meat with salt. Place it in the tub and spread salt under and around the meat so that it is completely covered. If there is extra salt, keep it handy. Cover the salted meat with parchment or plastic and refrigerate, or leave in a cellar or other cool spot. In many climates, slaughter and curing were done only in cold weather, as warm temperatures can spoil meat quickly before salt penetrates. Every couple of days, take the salting meat out of the refrigerator to check it. Pour off the liquid that will accumulate in the tub as the salt pulls it from the meat. Redistribute salt over the surface as needed, and turn the meat so that the surface that was facing down faces up. As necessary, use any extra salt that was left over from the initial salting, and add further salt as needed to keep the surface salted. Notice how the meat changes, becoming firmer as it loses water. The initial salting will take approximately 1 to 2 days for each pound or 500 grams of meat. The best way to judge when it has been adequately salted is to weigh it. From water losses, the meat should lose about 15% of its initial weight. Once you determine that your meat has completed the salting phase, rinse it in fresh water and dry the surface. Spread a layer of lard over the surface to prevent it from drying and potentially cracking, and sprinkle cracked peppercorns into the lard, which help keep insects away. Wrap the whole salted, larded, and peppered piece of meat in a few layers of cheesecloth. Then tie the whole mummified package with string, finishing off with a loop by which to hang it. Hang the meat to cure in a cool, dry spot, such as an unheated cellar, for 6 months or longer. Water will continue to drain from the meat, so you will find some drip residue on the ground under it. The meat will feel firmer as time passes and is ready when it has lost at least 1/3 of its original weight. Wipe away the lard coating, slice thinly, and enjoy. The deer thigh I cured in this way came out great. After 6 months of aging, it was tasty and tender and attractive. I got the idea to cure deer meat in this prosciutto style from tasting a wonderful cured goat thigh at Terra Madre, the international slow food event in Italy. The meat was called violino di capra, violin of goat, because it is shaped something like a violin. It is a specialty of Valchiavenna in northern Italy, and its slow food purveyor held it and sliced it as if it were one. This meat was not only incredibly rich and delicious, but tender, no easy feat for the meat of an 8-year-old dairy goat. The conventional wisdom I had always heard was that the only goat meat worth eating, to the extent that goat meat is considered worth eating at all, is that of young kids just a few months old, for after that the musculature of these highly active creatures becomes extremely tough. Subsistence cultures, without the luxury of overabundance, pioneered strategies such as this for rendering foods not only stable for preservation, but also tastier and tenderer, strategies that have largely been abandoned. Most of the guidance I could find in books and online for my deer shooto experiment was geared toward curing pigs rather than goats or deer. For the most part, the procedures for curing different meats are pretty similar. The only problem with my deer shooto was that it was way too salty, because I salted it for over a month, a length of time more appropriate for a pig's thigh than a deer's. Evaluating adequate salting time by weighing the meat regularly to gauge 15% water loss should avoid oversalting. Brining, corned beef and tongue. An even simpler way to salt meat is in brine. Turning salt into liquid makes it an especially effective tool because it touches 100% of the food's surface in a uniform concentration, observes chef Michael Rollman. In our time, people usually brine meat primarily to flavor and tenderize it rather than to preserve it, but the original reason for the practice was preservation. Possibly the best-known brined meat is corned beef. Corn is an archaic English word for any small, hard particle, whether of grain, sand, or salt. Thus, salted beef is corned beef. In ancient Ireland, beef was salted and buried in peat bogs. Over time, this practice evolved into a brining process. Homemade corned beef, made from brisket, considered one of the toughest of beef cuts, is so tender it practically melts in your mouth. Much of that tenderness derives from brining the meat. Tongue, a luscious fatty meat, is brined in exactly the same way. Start by mixing a brine of about 10% salt and 5% sugar, roughly 6 tablespoons salt and 3 tablespoons sugar per quart/liter of brine. Many recipes call for saltpeter or other curing salts. As with prosciutto or other dry salted whole slabs of meat, the nitrate and nitrite are used purely to give the meat an extra bright red color, rather than as a necessary botulism inhibitor, so I don't include them, and I've found the meat to remain plenty red nonetheless. I'm willing to use these compounds where there is a safety imperative, but not for the sake of appearance alone. A 6-pound or 2.5-kilogram brisket takes about 3 quarts or liters of brine. A 2-pound or 1-kilogram tongue takes about 1 quart or liter. I like to add cloves, garlic, peppercorns, and bay leaves to the brine. I've also seen juniper berries, thyme, cinnamon, allspice, and ginger used in published recipes. Spice the brine as desired. Add salt, sugar, and spices to dechlorinated water, stirring until the salt and sugar are completely dissolved. Most contemporary corned beef recipes recommend brining in the refrigerator. If you have fridge space, use it. If not, you'll need a cool spot like a root cellar. Typical ambient temperatures around 68 degrees Fahrenheit or 20 degrees Celsius will result in some really nasty meat after a few days. Unfortunately, I can't tell you exactly how high a temperature meat in brine can tolerate. There is a relationship between brine strength, temperature, and time. At warmer temperatures, use stronger brine and shorter brining time. And all meat curing has traditionally been a seasonal activity undertaken in relatively cool temperatures. I would advise against brining for more than overnight at temperatures above about earth temperature, 55 degrees Fahrenheit or 13 degrees Celsius. At refrigerator temperatures, brine meat for about 10 days to 2 weeks. I think the easiest way is in a sealed Ziploc bag in one of the crisper drawers, but you can improvise. Flip the brining meat over every few days. When brining is complete, rinse the brisket under fresh water, then place it in a pot and cover it by about an inch or 2.5 centimeter with water. Add an onion and a little more, fresh, of whatever spices you used in the brine. Bring to a boil, then reduce the heat and simmer for 2 to 3 hours until the meat easily comes apart with a fork. Add chopped potato and wedges of cabbage and cook about 15 minutes more until the potatoes are tender. Remove the meat and veggies from the water, slice the meat, and enjoy your corned beef. Instead of boiling corned beef, you can prepare your cured brisket as pastrami by rubbing lots of coarsely ground pepper, coriander, and other spices into it and smoking it. For tongue, after brining, I follow the directions in my trusty 1975 edition of Joy of Cooking. Place tongue in cold water, bring to a boil, and simmer for about 10 minutes. Remove the tongue from the hot water and immerse in cold water. Then place in a pot with fresh water, onion, and a little more, fresh, of whatever spices you used in the brine. Cook about 50 minutes per pound or 500 grams. Remove tongue from the cooking water and plunge briefly in cold water to cool it so you can handle it. The skin will have partially separated from the tongue. Peel it off entirely and discard. Remove any bones or gristle from the base of the tongue. Return the tongue to the cooking water to rewarm if serving hot. Slice on a diagonal. Sliced tongue is also wonderful cold as a sandwich meat with mustard. Now that we've gotten this far, I will concede that brining meat like this in the refrigerator involves little, if any, significant fermentation. But it sure is good. Dry cured sausages. The meat products most frequently described as fermented are dry cured sausages, widely known as salamis. Lactic acid production from fermentation, along with curing and air drying, preserves the meat and other bacteria, specifically of the genera Staphylococcus and Coccuria, formerly known as Micrococcus, facilitate the curing by metabolizing nitrate into nitrite. Yeasts and molds also contribute to the process. Two things are special about salamis that facilitate effective fermentation. First, the mincing or grinding of the meat exposes greater surface area, which results in increased contact with fermentation organisms, as well as spoilage organisms and potential pathogens, and more nutrients available to them. The mincing and mixing also enable a range of added ingredients, salt, curing salts, spices, carbohydrates to nourish lactic acid bacteria and starter cultures, to be evenly distributed in the meat. The other feature of salamis that encourages healthy fermentation, drying, and aging is the protection afforded them by the casings, made from animal intestines, in which the meat is stuffed. The special quality of these intestinal tubes is that they are robust enough to act as a barrier against airborne contaminants, yet permeable enough to breathe, explains Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall. Natural molds bloom on the outside of the salami, but can't penetrate and spoil the meat. A fly may even lay its eggs on one, but the tiny hatched maggots simply won't get through the skin. Given a reasonable circulation of cool air, these natural casings allow steady moisture loss and gradual dehydration, until the salami reach the required state of ripeness, firm, dense, and richly flavored with just a hint of residual moisture. Many contemporary fermented sausages are only briefly fermented, sometimes followed by cold smoking to flavor the sausages and improve their longevity under refrigeration. These are fast-fermented or semi-dry sausages and are often intended to be cooked before eating. These typically involve the use of starter cultures to assure rapid acidification of the sausages during the brief and often warm fermentation period. However, most traditional fermented sausages, such as salamis, are cured, fermented, and dried at low temperatures and moderately high humidity for several months. Their safety and effective preservation is the result of a combination of interventions, together known as the hurdle effect, each of which is applied in a moderate way so that they are only effective when applied together. Though salt and curing salts, drying, or acidification could theoretically preserve the meat as a singular strategy, the result would be excessively salty, dry, or sour. By combining these methods, but applying each in moderation, the salami retains moisture, flavor, and appeal. Once sufficiently salted, cured, acidified, and dried, salamis and other fermented sausages are stable indefinitely if stored in a cool, dark spot and are generally eaten raw without any further processing. The process has traditionally been quite simple. To make salami, mince meat and fat. Mix it with salt, curing salts, and spices. Sometimes sugar, or in the Thai tradition, rice, is added to contribute additional carbohydrates to support acidification. Stuff the mixture into casings, hang in a cool, moderately humid environment so it ferments slowly and doesn't dry out too fast. Historically, this has been a seasonal activity, done only during cool weather in places with appropriate climate. As always, food traditions evolve in their particular geographic contexts. The only thing hard about dry curing salamis at home is controlling heat and humidity to simulate these conditions. Even though the process of dry curing is not especially complex, there is no topic treated by food writers with greater forewarning and trepidation than curing meats, observes food historian and fermentation enthusiast Ken Albala in his intrepid The Lost Art of Real Cooking. I've treated the topic with a certain amount of caution myself, with stern warnings earlier in this chapter about botulism standing in stark contrast with the try-anything-and-don't-worry attitude of the rest of the book, because there is a real potential for danger. Yet I agree absolutely with Ken when he writes, "With a few basic precautions, there is no reason not to cure your own meat, nor quake in fear at the prospect of poisoning yourself." I tried my hand at dry curing sausages for the first time as I wrote this, so I am certainly no expert. Most of what I have to share I have learned from reading, as well as visits, tastings, conversations, and correspondences with meat curing farmers, artisans, hobbyists, and other experimentalists. But the result of my first try was the most delicious salami I have ever eaten. My friend Vincent and I hand minced the meat and fat, so it was chunky, and those big chunks just melted on my tongue. Yum! The major challenge in dry curing meat, especially as a novice without a dedicated setup, is how to maintain the environment at optimum temperature and humidity. Except for the initial few days of fermentation, which often take place at warmer temperature, salamis are best dry cured in an environment with temperatures in the range of 54 to 59 degrees Fahrenheit, or 13 to 15 degrees Celsius, and 80 to 85% humidity. The reason it's so important to maintain a humid environment, even though the objective is drying the sausages, is that if the environment is too dry, the outside of the sausages will dry fast, trapping moisture inside and leading to spoilage. If you observe that the casings of your sausages are drying out, slow down their drying by lightly misting them with water. A friend of mine rigged up an old refrigerator so it plugs into a controllable external thermostat, which enables me to control temperatures. Inside the fridge, I placed an open pan of heavily salted water to help maintain humidity. The salt discourages mold from forming on the surface of the water, as well as a hygrometer, humidity meter, sensor to monitor humidity. When the humidity got below 80%, I'd open the door for a moment to let the humid summer air in and occasionally spray a light mist. Friends of mine have also used wine refrigerators, and an online search will yield many other clever improvisational ideas for dry curing chambers. In the right climate, season, and cellar, this can be done very simply in an unheated cellar. Once I figured out my incubation chamber, the biggest dilemma I faced was whether to rely on wild fermentation or use a starter culture. Almost all of the mainstream literature, at least in the United States, will tell you to use starter cultures. And in contemporary salami making in the United States, use of starter cultures has become the norm. The oldest form of culturing in this context, practiced long before any specific organisms were ever isolated, is backslopping, which is simply introducing a small amount of already fermented sausage stuffing into a fresh batch, just like culturing fresh milk with already fermented yogurt. As with dairy cultures, microbiologists have isolated selected bacterial strains. These commercially available cultures are widely believed to produce more consistent results than traditional wild fermentation, and to make sausage making safer by starting fermentation faster and thus reducing the lag time before pH begins to fall. In the latest production methods, huge numbers of lactic acid bacteria, starter cultures, are introduced into the meat right at the beginning of the process, and that guarantees healthy and strong fermentation, write Stanley and Adam Mariansky, co-authors of The Art of Making Fermented Sausages. These armies of beneficial bacteria start competing for food with other undesirable bacteria types, decreasing their chances for growth and survival. Traditionally, fermented sausages have been made with organisms that find their way onto the meat during processing. In most cases, sufficient numbers of the microorganisms necessary are present in the raw material, reports German microbiologist and food scientist Friedrich Karl Lucke. The 2007 Handbook of Fermented Meat and Poultry states that reliance on natural flora results in products with inconsistent quality and advocates the use of starter cultures. Even so, the authors acknowledge a trade-off, as starter use translates into a lot of very good and acceptable product. However, very little extremely excellent product is produced, because most starter cultures are a combination of just a few species of microorganisms, and they cannot produce as balanced a flavor as sometimes can be obtained when many species are included. This corroborates the analysis of food historian and cookbook author Ken Albala, who writes, "In the name of food safety, predictability, and product consistency, these foods are routinely inoculated with lab-tested, carefully controlled strains of microorganisms. The unique properties of local bacterial populations are thus obliterated through such seemingly benign processes as pasteurization, or crowded out with super quick-acting starter cultures. The result is bland, homogeneous food catering to the lowest common gastronomic denominator. Flavorless, characterless, sterile products no longer reflect place but the demands of the industrial marketplace, which require long-distance shipping, stable shelf life, and most importantly, uniformity and consistency." Ken suggests that mixing the sausage ingredients together using your own clean but unprotected hands is an effective way to introduce fermenting bacteria. The biggest concern most modern authorities have is how to get the bacteria to colonize the chopped meat. Since you are using your hands, this should be no problem. This is the way it has always been done until a few decades ago. Artisan salami makers using traditional methods are being forced by regulators to defend their practices. Because he did not have a kill step in his processing, heating, irradiating, or using chemical preservatives, and because he was not introducing selected cultures, New York salami maker Mark Buzzio, proprietor of Manhattan Salumeria Bialesi, had to prove to the U.S. Department of Agriculture that the traditionally fermented salamis he produces were safe. Making cured sausages the same way your father did, the way others have for hundreds of years, doesn't constitute proof. Neither does the fact that no one ever gets sick on your product, or that you use only heirloom pork and tend to your salamis like some people tend to their children. It isn't even proof if your product tests negative for bacteria. All the USDA cares about is the process. The traditional method, raw meat transformed into an edible product with nothing but a little salt and a lot of time, makes them very nervous. What Buzzio had to do to prove the safety of his process was commission a scientist who was frequently cited by the agency for over $100,000 to study it. The scientist followed Salumeria Bialesi's process to the letter, with one exception. He injected each product with pure E. coli and L. mycetogenes, producing much higher levels of bacteria than would normally be found in raw meat. Then he aged the products in the same way that they are aged at the Salumeria. When the scientist tested the meats at the end of the aging period, he found that the very high levels of bacteria had been eliminated. Essentially, his study validated what centuries of practice had already demonstrated, that dry aging, when done knowledgeably and with care, makes raw meat safe to eat. The USDA accepted the study as proof, and Buzzio continues to be one of the most celebrated salami makers in the United States. Fidel Toldrá, the Spanish author of several textbooks on dry-cured and fermented meats, characterizes the selective environment of the dry-cured sausage. The origin and composition of the microflora naturally present in the raw sausage mix is diverse. There are many factors that determine which microflora are present, such as the hygiene in meat manipulation, the environment, and microorganisms present in the additives. However, the presence of salt and nitrite, oxygen depletion, pH drop, reduction in AW, and accumulation of certain metabolites, like bacteriocins, during the processing will result in a kind of selectivity that favors the development of coccuria, staphylococcus, and lactic acid bacteria, but will prevent the growth of undesirable microflora like pathogenic and spoilage microorganisms. As in most fermentations, the environment selects the bacteria. The hard part is creating the appropriate environment, not getting the bacteria there. Starters may speed things up and improve consistency, but they are not necessities, and most of what are considered the best artisan salamis, like the best artisan cheeses, are made with the broad spectrum of indigenous bacteria that are naturally occurring rather than a mix of selected strains. To try to evaluate the starter question experientially, I prepared two batches of salami otherwise identical in meat, grind, salting, curing salts, sugar, and spicing. Half I stuffed into the casings with no added starter, and to the other half I added a culture I bought, called T-SPX. The flavor of both salamis was wonderful. The thin slices just melted in my mouth. I could not discern any difference, really. I do not feel that the cultured ones were enhanced by their culturing, nor were the spontaneously cultured ones noticeably more complex or special. My experiment demonstrated to me that either approach can produce excellent salami. But of course, that is determined by many factors. More than anything, good quality salami requires good quality meat. I got pork and back fat from a farmer friend, Bill Keener, in Whitwell, Tennessee. Any type of meat may be used for sausages, typically with a good amount of minced fat mixed with lean meat to keep the sausages moist and rich. Meat may be ground with a mechanical grinder or chopped by hand. Both the meat and fat may be chopped finely or coarsely for a more rustic appearance. Note, fat is much easier to mince when partially frozen. Meat should be kept cold and not left at ambient room temperature for long periods, and tools and workspace should be as clean as possible. Because of the warm, moist conditions involved with dry-curing foods, bacteria can multiply with abandon, explain Michael Ruhlman and Brian Polson in their book Charcuterie. So sanitation is a much more salient concern than when cooking with food that will be cooked or eaten immediately. Natural casings need to be soaked in several changes of cold water and rinsed before stuffing, in order to remove salt and make them flexible. Larger casings, like beef middles, take much longer to dry, 3 to 4 months, than smaller casings, 3 to 4 weeks. For novices, the best strategy is to start with skinny items, sausages that don't take long to dry, sausage stuffed into sheep casings or hog casings, advise Ruhlman and Polson. The longer something takes to dry, the greater potential for problems. For curing salts, the long curing involved in dry-cured sausages requires both nitrite and nitrate, which bacteria metabolize into nitrite in a slow release. In the United States, this combination is sold as Cure No. 2. Actually, Cure No. 2 is mostly sodium chloride, with 6.25% sodium nitrite and 4% sodium nitrate. For safe dry-cured sausages, use 0.2% Cure No. 2 in relation to meat, which translates to 1 level teaspoon per 5 pounds of meat, or 2 grams per kilogram. Cures available in other places may contain different proportions, so follow guidelines. But for dry-cured sausages, be sure to use curing salts with nitrate as well as nitrite. For salt, use 3 to 3.5% based on the weight of the meat if you are relying on wild fermentation. With starter cultures, you can use as little as 2%. Many recipes call for sugar, generally no more than 0.3%. Some specify dextrose, which is a name for glucose, because it is the most basic form of sugar used by cells as a source of energy. And, as Stanley and Adam Mariansky explain, only it can be fermented directly into lactic acid by all lactic acid bacteria. Add seasonings and spices as desired. Some recipes call for a little wine. I had access to a simple mechanical stuffer and stuffed some using that. Some I stuffed manually using a tube that came with the mechanical stuffer. A large funnel is often recommended for hand stuffing. Both ways, I had to restuff the first sausages I did, as there is a tactile learning curve to seeing how full and how fast to stuff the casings. But I caught on quickly, and both ways produced firm, full, evenly stuffed sausages. I rather enjoyed the manual stuffing, and for small batches, I think it works perfectly well. When you notice air pockets in the stuffed sausage, inevitable in home production, poke them with a flame-sterilized pin to release the trapped air and enable the casing to shrink around the meat. Typically, molds develop on salamis as they dry cure. The most commonly found molds are of the genera Penicillium, Aspergillus, Mucor, and Cladosporium. A thick layer of desirable molds on the surface serves as protection against the adverse effects of oxygen and light and prevents mycotoxigenic molds from becoming established, explains Fidel Toldra. In fact, in some commercial and home production, the surfaces of salamis are cultured with mold spores. Some of the literature suggests discarding salamis that develop molds that are green or any color except white. But many traditionalists dispute that advice. A number of molds, ranging in color from gray-green to white and even orange, may form on the casings, explains Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall. None of these should worry you. While modern processors employ science to maintain an aesthetically pleasing white mold, nature on its own will normally generate an artist's palette of colors, write John Pacetti, François Vecchio, and Joyce Goldstein in their book Salumi. My salamis developed hues of white, gray, and blue-green as they dry-cured. My confidence in the moldy salamis was bolstered by the pleasant, alluring aroma that wafted from the curing chamber each time I inspected them. As with any fermentation process, the big question is, how will I know when it's ready to eat? With dry-cured sausages, this is mostly a matter of the sausages losing enough water to be shelf-stable. The easiest way to gauge this is by weighing the sausages when they are first made, recording their weight, and then weighing them periodically as they cure to monitor dryness. Dry-cured sausages are usually ready when they have lost about one-third of their original weight. The length of time this takes will vary from a few weeks to a few months, depending above all on sausage diameter. Thicker salamis take longer to dry than thin ones, as well as humidity, temperature, air movement, and other ripening conditions. I tried mine after a month, by which time they had lost about 40% of their weight. After that, I hung them in a dark corner of the basement, where they did fine despite the hot and humid summer weather.